the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show. I'm Jen, and today on Signal Boost, we have Gideon Marcus, founder of the Serling Award-winning website Galactic Journey. Welcome to the show, Gideon.
Happy to be here.
I was going to say, or should I call you the Traveler?
You can if you like. When I started the first few months, I was sort of anonymous, and then I was told by a very good friend who's much famouser than I am, Erica Friedman, saying, no, be yourself, be proud of yourself.
Yes, absolutely. So why don't you tell us a little bit about The Traveler and tell us what Galactic Journey is? Why are you here?
So galacticjourney.org is a time machine. I basically have a portal to exactly 55 years in the past. Or one might say 55 years in the future, and I live in the past day by day as it goes. So if you go to galacticjourney.org, it is a blog written by someone who lives in the past. But it's today. So John Glenn just flew, for instance. The war in Indochina is heating up. But it's a blog by a fan for fans. So the outside world is almost incidental. What I'm really writing about is the science fiction movies. The Twilight Zone is coming out, finishing its third season, going to conventions, but the conventions are conventions of the time. All the things that a fan might have done 55 years ago, and you'll find that it's not that different from what fans do today. So that's what Galactic Journey is. It's this window into a time that some of our older fans remember personally, but maybe it's sort of a distant memory. And for a lot of people, it's just this alien time. And there's a lot of good stuff back there. So I wanted to give people sort of a guiding hand to this curated experience of fandom of the past.
Yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating kind of digging into what you have on there and realizing that it was exactly 55 years ago and that you were doing the day by day. You just had, for instance, a letter to the editor from someone who went to not a Vietnam War protest, exactly the escalation of hostilities in Indochina. So where are you in that journey and how big of an effect? Because I was like, oh my goodness. Okay. So this is happening. What else was happening in 1962? And then I remembered Cuban Missile Crisis and whatnot. So you have a lot of
no spoilers.
Sorry. Since I'm the traveler from the future, I suppose I get to spoil things though.
I do get spoilers from the future in my comments, which is great. This is the coolest thing about the journey. People will and have for the past several years, they would comment in character. Sometimes they start out of character and then they'd sort of get the shtick. And so now we'll have heated debates on what's better, wire or tape recorder, for instance. And of course, tape is better. We talk about music. This is when we started, it was just me. And it started because my wife saw my thousands of science fiction magazines that I was slowly pouring through and saying, recommend some good ones for me. And I said, you know what? I'll write a blog, you know, three people will read this and it's gotten a bit bigger. And as people have commented on the blog and sort of joined the journey, a lot of them have become writers. And now I think there's 10 of us writing for the journey.
And mostly a crew of women, which is really cool.
Yes. But you wanted to know what's going on.
I can get back to the journey in a minute. So you do have mostly women writing for this, which is actually one of my questions anyway. You know, how do they deal with, you know, sort of the rampant bigotry of classic science fiction?
The madman chauvinism of the time?
Yes, exactly.
So this is interesting. And I actually got asked on an interview a couple of years ago, aren't you kind of anachronistic with your sort of progressive views on race and gender equality? I'm like, it's not like I invented feminism, and it's not like feminism didn't exist in 1960. In fact, it was second wave feminism at that point. So this is interesting. I did not start my blog to be sort of this progressive movement thing. I don't think I can help it. I don't think I can be a 21st century person and not have something of a forward thinking. I hope. I mean, I imagine there's fans who look back 55 years ago and go, those were the good old days. But as I was reading very quickly, I found myself going, are there any women writers in this magazine? Oh, there are. Good, good. And I looked forward to those stories, you know. Oh, this guy's from Mexico. Okay, I'm interested in. Oh, this one stars a black person. Oh, okay, I'm interested. Because you read, even if the stories are different, if you read the same viewpoint over and over and over again, you get tired of it. And whenever you get something different, it's exciting. And because people of color and women had these hurdles, extra hurdles to jump, whether they were self-imposed or imposed by society, the quality tended to be better anyway. The statistic I always quote is 25% of the good stuff is written by the 10% that are women. And I don't think any person is inherently better at something than anybody else, but because of the unique situation of the time, you ended up with that proportion. Similarly, I didn't want to just hear from me, so I'm just one viewpoint. I'm a male viewpoint. And I want to get input from diverse viewpoints. So my daughter, for instance, is 13, and she's been writing for The Journey since last year, and I think she does a good job.
That's adorable.
Well, I hope you appreciate just the quality of her writing, too. It's not just nepotism that keeps her on the book.
No, of course not.
Right, but she's someone who is absolutely not from... I'm not from the time. I was born in 74. And she's absolutely removed from the time, and yet she can appreciate good stuff. She can tell the bad stuff, too, and there was bad stuff, plenty of bad stuff back then, just like there is now. So all of these people from all these diverse backgrounds just, I think, add to the experience. And frankly, this is what I want to read, and that's why they're here.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how do you sort of select which events and which stories get highlighted in the journey as you're going along? But clearly it's the stuff that you want to read to an extent. But what else is sort of the criteria for selecting which stories get reviewed, for instance?
That's a great question. So The Journey started out strictly magazines and space shots. And the reason for that was pragmatic. I have a large collection of magazines I inherited from my father, which I started reading in historical order once a month to make sure I would do it. And also because it was neat getting this sort of gestalt of the time. And I happen to be a professional space historian with an emphasis on the late 50s, early 60s. So these are just things I knew, so it'd be really easy to get the articles out, and I could write about it with more depth than you might get from Wikipedia or somebody writing about it today. Gee, wasn't this cool? So, but I can only read so much in a month. So I would read the big three magazines every month, and occasionally I'd throw in a book. And then my job started taking more of my time, amazingly enough. But I was like, but people would say, oh, did you catch Roselle George Brown's story in Amazing this month? And I'd be like, no, but I really would have liked to because she's an author I really like. And so I got very lucky when Victoria Silverwolf, who was one of my more erudite fans, said she would be happy to cover Fantastic. And then John Boston, who apparently is a big name fan, and I'm embarrassed that I didn't know who he was when he introduced himself to me, and who's literally written the book on Amazing science fiction. By the way, Amazing and Fantastic were both helmed by a woman editor named Sol Goldsmith in the early 60s. So he offered to do Amazing. So now I'm covering all of the big magazines of the time. And then Rose Benton, who lives back east, who has a master's in Cold War pop culture, she covers books every month. And then Ashley Pollard is my UK correspondent. With a little bit of anachronistic forethinking, I know Doctor Who's going to come out next year. I know it's going to be a big deal. And I've seen all the early episodes, but there's no way that the Traveler could have seen them.
That's exciting.
Right? So we're going to have Doctor Who on the ground as it happens starting November next year.
Oh, wow. Wow. That will be very cool. So that actually leads perfectly back into where are you in the journey? I know the conflict in Indochina is escalating, but how do you see, as you've gone along, how do you see the current events, the civil rights movement that is going to be blowing up soon, the Bay of Pigs invasion, things like that? How do you see that affecting the stories that were being written at the time?
Another great question. So the thing about the time travel that I do, and I don't I don't think I've ever seen anyone else do this. Most people, when they time travel, it's sort of magpie time travel. You know, oh, I want to see the Civil War. Oh, I want to see George Washington cross the Delaware. I want to see, you know, Rosa Parks stand up on the bus. And it's very isolated and it's very contextual to you in your modern time. When you live in a time day by day, you experience it and you can only look back and have a very limited view of the future. So where I am right now, for instance, talking about, say, music changed violently in the mid-50s. All of it went from schmaltzy white people music to rock and roll, and a new kind of jazz. And it was really exciting and different. And now it's sort of getting overripe. You know, there's a new dance craze every month and it's some kind of twist, variation on the twist, and it's getting kind of boring. And there's some instrumental music, you know, the Ventures have come out, the Shadows in England have come out. There's a new Motown sound, which is kind of exciting, but it's still nothing. It's ripe for a change. And there's surf music's coming out and that's big in California. But in general, we're like, well, what's the next thing? And of course, anyone who lived through the 60s knows what's coming next year. I mean, even in October, the Beatles are going to come out with Love Me Do. But we don't know that back where I am. All we know is want something to change, but we don't know what's out there yet. Same thing with civil rights. Civil rights is exciting right now. We just had last summer a bunch of people riding the freedom buses. So people going from the north into the south in an integrated fashion, daring the police to arrest them. And that culminated in the court saying, no, you cannot discriminate on the bus, okay? Obey the law. And yet we're still a far, far way from segregation being over. This school year, I'm starting to read the newspaper accounts of the first integrated schools. And that's exciting. It's a process. At the same time, you asked me about Indochina, and one person might say, well, you know, we know Vietnam is a pretty bad event for American history, and, you know, tens of thousands of people are going to die on our side, not to mention the tens and hundreds of thousands of other people. And would they really have made a big deal about it in 1962? Well, apparently yes, because I read the paper every day. I tend to read the Chicago Tribune because they have great scans of it. It's a horribly conservative paper, but they do have good news. And every day it's, you know, Laotian Civil War continues, South Vietnam buildup of troops up to 6,000 people. And it's just, you can just tell the Secretary of Defense has said, this isn't going to take months, it's going to take years. So even in 62, they knew this stuff was coming. And it's all sideshow to the Berlin Wall has just gone up, communism has come to Cuba, Kennedy is sort of back on his heels with an expanding Khrushchev. And the only bright spot, if you can see it, is that Soviet communism and Chinese communism have split recently. So, yeah, a tumultuous time and not very clear wind vanes as to where things are going to go in the next few years.
Right, absolutely. So how does that affect the stories, though, of all the science fiction that's being written at the time? Clearly, the Cold War had a pretty big impact. So how do you see that affecting the stories?
Right. A couple of ways. So by 1962, you've got writers fairly consistently portraying people of different nationalities other than American, and people of other ethnicities than just white Anglo-Saxon Protestant in stories. They'll talk about, you know, occasionally halfway through the story, his ebony features or whatever. Occasionally you see women in prominent roles. Occasionally you see fairly well integrated sexually and ethnically stories. So they're sort of about 20 years ahead. In terms of the pervading, one in 10 stories is going to deal with an after the bomb sort of scenario. Just everyone sort of assumed that things are so bad. We're 2 minutes to midnight and it's entirely possible things are going to light up. But if I was to say the thing that is affecting the science fiction psyche the most, it's overpopulation.
Oh.
Right? And you're like, what?
That was an unexpected answer.
That's right. In 1961, that was the last year that population grew at an exponential rate in the sort of Malthusian doubles all the time rate. And people were greatly concerned about it. They were worried that the Earth could only hold so many people, And once we hit some ridiculously large number, like 6 billion, then we'd all be standing shoulder to shoulder and eating yeast. And this is something that almost nobody got. We talk about science fiction sort of predicting the future, but no one really got. In 1961, Enovid went on the market, and women had birth control. And obviously it wasn't perfect yet, but the pill revolutionized things. And after 1961, the population stopped growing at that rate. But it took a long time for pop culture to catch up with that. So if 1 in 10 stories is a after the bomb stories, then I'd say 2 in 10 stories deal with some kind of overpopulation. And that's why people are leaving the earth. I'm reading a Robert Silverberg story right now called The Seeds of Earth, which has people being exported by draft from the earth 100 every day. Because the earth is overpopulated.
That's amazing. I had never considered that sort of one of the fears. I mean, obviously, it's been one of those sort of background things of, oh my goodness, the world is getting overpopulated. But I had never actually considered it as something affecting science fiction stories. That's amazing. I look forward to that review.
It's one of the first articles I wrote. If you have links on this.
Absolutely. That's actually a perfect time. So tell us where people can find you and your work.
So if you go to galacticjourney.org, you'll see it. And everything's tagged. So if you're just interested in comics of the time. So for instance, Marvel's just coming out with a bunch of people you may have heard of, like The Incredible Hulk, The Fantastic Four. Spider-Man is debuting next month. Thor is debuting next month. National Comics, which is now DC, has, of course, a bunch of characters that everybody knows. If you're interested in conventions, you can hit the tag on that. I just went to WonderCon, and the game I play is I take pictures of things that could only have existed in 1962 or earlier. So I was very excited to find a blue skirt Supergirl.
Oh, that's awesome.
Or you can click on magazines or whatever strikes your fancy. You'll probably find enough material to keep you busy for a long time.
Awesome. I look forward to the X-Men reviews next year, too.
Yes.
Glimpse into the future. I just went back and read all of those, so I'm excited about that.
Oh, fantastic.
So it's time to wrap up, unfortunately. I probably could talk to you for at least an hour, but on Signal Boost, you only get 15 minutes. So thank you so much for joining us today and telling us about Galactic Journey.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Skippy and Fanti Show. I'm Jen, and today on Signal Boost, we have Andrew Barton, self-proclaimed scientificationist, photographic dabbler, transit nerd, and sadly failed political candidate. With a personal blog, Acts of Minor Treason, and short fiction out from magazines like Analog, and a story in the upcoming anthology, No Shit, There I Go. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work, specifically Tailings, your review series on classic science fiction stories.
All right. Yeah. Well, I'm a science fiction writer, mostly focusing in short fiction. Like you said, I've had stories in Analog, that No Shit anthology, and other anthologies up here that I can go into later if there's time. But what I was really interested in talking about today, especially since you were interested, was my review series on my blog, Tailings of the Golden Age, which is where I take a closer look at stories from that era people have completely forgotten.
So why Tailings of the Golden Age?
Well, for two reasons, because I've really had it with people talking about how the Golden Age is great. Like, the Golden Age was everything that was excellent about science fiction. It should be held up and lionized and everything like that. But the thing is, like, in my day job, I work at a communications company, and I see a lot of news from mining companies, and especially gold mining companies. And when you're mining gold, it's measured in grams per ton, and this is how many grams you get from moving a ton of dirt? How many grams of gold from getting a ton of dirt? And with Golden Age stories, it's the same way. There are a few there that we still remember today by major names, but around them is a lot of dirt. And that's what I'm looking for when I'm doing these reviews. I'm looking for things that I've never heard of, probably you've never heard of, where reviews of these do not exist anywhere on the internet. And I'm taking a sharper look at them, especially, well, obviously in the context of today, because I feel like it's appropriate and look at it and say, is this all really worth all of the focus we put on it?
Interesting. One of your columns specifically, the very first one that you did, was Blitz Against Japan. So I'm curious, which is, it's just a fascinating overview of a story about Pearl Harbor and sort of the reaction to it, it looks like. So I'm curious, if you could talk more about that story, and then how you go about deciding which pieces you want to write about. How do you find the dirt, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I'll go in terms of finding first. Like, for that other story, would have to be a bit possibly vague, because I wrote that review 3 years ago, and it's not exactly the sort of story that's worth rereading, honestly. But in terms of where I find these, like, I go to conventions, I go to Worldcon, and here in Toronto every year in May, so it'll be around the time this episode airs, actually, there is what's called a pulp show and sale in the basement of the library that houses the Merrill collection of science fiction. And so you have a bunch of vendors selling these old pulp magazines. And so I have over on by the other wall of my living room, I have bins full of issues of Astounding from the 40s and Thrilling Wonder Stories from the 30s, like these literally 80-year-old pulp magazines that fall apart when I try to read them. I really need to get like reading gloves. But when I go through them, part of me is looking for things that I see it and I know, oh, this is going to piss me off. And that's, like I said in the review, that's why I bought the Amazing Stories, I think September 1942, that had Blitz Against Japan as the cover story, because I've always had like a historical interest in the Second World War. It's something that I was studying when I was a kid. And so I had that historical awareness, but something like this offers the opportunity to more get in the heads of people who are living through the immediate aftermath in the US, and just to get an idea of what they were thinking about it. And it's really not pretty.
Yeah. I mean, this is basically directly after the attack, isn't it?
Yeah. Because, the publication dates then were very offset. I think if that one, I think would have, come out around, been on the stands in around June of 1942.
Wow.
And that point, yeah. So at that point, it was like around the time of the Battle of Midway. So at about the time when Japan was at its highest point in terms of its successes in the Pacific War, is like around like after the fall of the Philippines, after the Battle of the Coral Sea, like right around the time of the Battle of Midway. And so it really comes through in the story about how this feeling that the U.S., the cultural feeling that it was, had its back against the wall. And it was like, it's the sort of thing that's very interesting reading from the benefit of living in the future, because I can look at it and point to like dozens of different things and say, no, this couldn't happen. There's no way this could happen. This is horribly, horrendously racist and you should be ashamed. But it's very illuminating to be able to get that perspective. And I think that's one of the huge things that is worthwhile about going back to these not like sort of hidden bits. And there's so much like, so much dross in it because I know a lot of people related to why I started this series. Like you see like so many people talking about today, oh, how like message fiction today. Well, fiction has always had messages and Blitz Against Japan had the message of it was right to intern the Japanese because in the story, they, one of the bits of background is the fact that they have, the author has San Francisco gassed from hidden projectors in the city. So basically, you, its message being, yes, it was right and good that the U.S. did this, which is in not even in retrospect, which in, is just completely monstrous. But it's not just monsters, it's, this is a golden age attempting to justify that monstrousness.
But that the mind just boggled. I mean, because I really have never gone back and looked at these things. So Tailings of the Golden Age is exactly, I think, what people need sort of as a perspective on what the roots of science fiction really are. Because I think we tend to ignore that.
Yeah. I mean, cause when I started out, I've been doing, like other general science fiction reviews of short fiction since like around 2009. But one thing I noticed as I was going through that I was tending to fall a lot more on older stories, like before the 80s, but especially in the 60s and before, like where I could find those actual physical things, because you can very much see it change and you can very much see things take shape and you can see them going through territory that looks very, very strange these days.
And amazingly, people are still writing stuff this gross and getting Hugo Awards for it. Well, not Hugo Awards, but nominations.
I almost think it's in a different category though, because I've seen on Twitter this GIF of the Olympic high jump winner, like versus like 52 years ago against today. And it's just when you, the winner today is just so like, not just higher, but so much more like twisting and turning in midair. And it's the same thing with these stories because stuff like Blitz Against Japan was the cover story of Amazing in 1942. And it was like, it was the first science fiction magazine at the time. It was like one of the titans of the field. It was one of two to survive the '40s. The other one being, being Astounding, which became Analog. And like, this was a horrible mess of a story and it got the cover page, and like the one I did most recently, the Goddess of World 21, which was the cover story of Fantastic in March 1957, and it is a mess of a story in terms of the area it covers. When I was reading that and digging through it, and there was so much that came up, and it's like this sort of stuff you would not ever see something like this published in a mainstream publication, fingers crossed, because there's always like the chance of like something slipping through. But like, I guess it's more along the lines of this is a thing I would not want to see getting that kind of traction anymore.
Yeah. I mean, to an extent, having the perspective of Tailings of the Golden Age, there is hopefully nobody who reads this takes it as kind of a, oh, look at how much progress we've made. We're good now. Because clearly we're still not.
Oh, no, totally.
We have made progress, clearly, by looking at the stories that you've reviewed so far. We have made some progress.
Yeah, no, it's not, the intent is not, look how good we are. It's more, they didn't even wash their hands then.
Yeah, amazing. It really is a great series of blog posts, you guys. So
thank you.
Definitely go and check it out. It's a fascinating perspective on the roots of science fiction. So we're getting towards the end. So I want to give you a chance to tell us a little bit more about your short fiction, because as you said, you've had quite a bit of short fiction published over the years, and I know you have some stuff coming out very soon. So if you could tell us a little bit about your short fiction work?
Well, I write hard science fiction, I guess, where I try to take as few liberties as possible with, having played Kerbal Space Program makes it so much easier to write about starships. I have a better idea of how things work in space. There is a story that I could not have, absolutely could not have written without knowing that. And my first pro sale was with Analog in the March 2013 issue. And since then, I've gone back to them multiple times. I have a story, like you said, in the No Shit, There I Was anthology that Alex Axe described as Stark. And I've also had a few in other anthologies from the Ottawa publisher, Bundoran Press, their anthology Strange Bedfellows, Second Contacts, and Lazarus Risen, which I think are maybe not that well known in the States, too. So that might be something, those might be something for people to look at if they're interested, because they are available electronically. And yeah, and in terms of what I tend to write, I didn't know this. I had to have it pointed out to me, but when I did, it was like a light bulb going, because I pretty much all of my stories tend to center around isolation in some respect, which I feel like kind of makes sense in that growing up in Canada, I've almost like absorbed that cultural feeling, because there's a lot of, in Canadian literature, you'll find a lot of things with regarding stories about people in isolated places confronting things like the elements. And so it's a pattern that kind of that well exports into things that are set in space. Yeah, like I have written stories set on Earth, but the thing is that all of the stories that I've written that are set on Earth are to a lesser or greater degree like science fiction mysteries.
So we are hitting our mark. So why don't you quickly let us know where we can find you and Tailings of the Golden Age and all of your work?
All right. Well, my main blog at actsofminortreason.com. And otherwise, I have Twitter, which is at Axe of Andrew B, because there are a lot of Andrews Barton on Twitter. Otherwise, yeah, and I just wanted to say that I should have brought this up earlier, but in case anyone was wondering about a scientificcionist, I didn't make that up. It is a very obsolete term for science fiction writers. It was at its peak of popularity in the 30s and 40s, which really fits with the whole Tailings timeline. I mean, otherwise, I call myself a science fictioneer.
Indeed, scientificcionist. As difficult as it is to get my mouth around it, is incredibly appropriate for Tailings of the Golden Age. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Andrew. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Of course, and thank you, listeners, for checking us out on Signal Booth. Got one more signal boost for you today. The Skiffy and Fanty Show is holding a fundraiser. If you donate and we reach our goal of $500, we have to review Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice. Or as I like to call it, Dawn of Crap. Just visit skiffyandfanty.com for all the details, or just go ahead and make your donation, then email a screenshot of the information to skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. Now more than ever, the world relies on the kindness of strangers, so please consider donating, even if you don't do it for us. Do it for the people that you share this beautiful life with. Thank you. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Chronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.